Thank you very much, Paul, and I'm very gratified to find so many people have found this topic of interest and come today. I should point out, by the way, to those of you who don't know me, that that's not my picture put up there. It's just that, you know, all mathematicians look alike. But well, I suppose the first thing to address is the question, why Galileo? And next slide, please. And for this purpose, I'll just draw attention to two quotations, a modern one by Einstein and one from two or three centuries ago from Newton, both of whom, well, Einstein is obviously referring to Galileo. It's not clear here that Newton is referring to Galileo as one of the giants, but we'll see shortly who the giants are that he has in mind, and in fact, Galileo was preeminent amongst those giants. And I should add that Newton was not a person renowned for his modesty, so that that he should speak of someone else in such a way is quite a remarkable thing. So, next, thank you. So, first of all, let's have a look at our man. Here's a picture of Galileo in somewhat later years. Clearly, still very a very alert man. Next, please. And here we have three pictures of him. The first one, I think, was painted when he was about 43. In fact, and the you might well say the second one is suggesting a man who has had some experience of the world not altogether good, and who in fact was faced the Italian Inquisition twice, I think both times before that picture was made. So it's very expressive, and here we have a blow-up of that very last one. So I think it's a very expressive face, and it's good to see this. The next one, please. This is the book that Paul referred to, published in 1638, and in English, Dialogues and Mathematical Demonstrations Concerning Two New Sciences. Now, the two new sciences referred to actually structural strength of materials and, in fact, motion under gravity. And this book was his last book, and arguably his most mature work, and it summarises and extends very much earlier work. It's also the one least tampered with by the authorities. The church wanted a number of disclaimers and modifications and toning down of his statements. This didn't occur in the last book because it was there'd already been a ban put on all his works by the church, both past and any future works he might write. And this particular one, he took advantage of the fact that Louis Elsevier was visiting Italy in 1636, and so Elsevier smuggled it out and published it at Leiden, which was well outside the reach of the Inquisition. And in fact, Galileo said, well, I didn't know they were going to publish it until they asked for my preface. So, Elsevier are very well-known publishers today, but they were already well-established back in 1636 when this book was received by Louis from Galileo. So, next, please. Just before I go on, I should perhaps note that the publication of certain books has changed history, and this book is one of them. It's one of the most influential books on science ever written, and we'll see something of its consequences later on. There are books that are good to own, like the first folios of Shakespeare. And it's important for such treasures to be spread over a variety of places. Otherwise, one can have disasters which destroy a whole corpus of material. If you have different parts of a corpus spread around, then the chance of survival is much greater. And the book that we have here on the table, you can see it sitting on the white cushion, was acquired by the library in 1979 and was the 1,000,000th volume acquired by the library. And I think in terms of the signal importance of this work and the fact that Adelaide has long had a prominent profile in mathematics and the sciences, it's very appropriate that we should have this particular book. So now we have Pisa. Galileo was born to a prominent Florentine family in Pisa in 1564. The family's fortunes had declined somewhat, and his father, Vincenzo, who was basically an aristocrat, he was an accomplished musician on the lute and very skilled with the theory of music, classical languages, and even mathematics, in fact, but he had to earn money at some stage, and I think part of the reason for going to Pisa was that it was embarrassing to be an aristocrat working for a living in your hometown, which was Florence. So he went to Pisa, and he taught music, had private pupils, and he also dabbled in the business of his wife's family. His wife was an Amanati. The Amanatis had a large cloth trade, in fact, cloth merchants. So he kept alive those ways. When he was 17, Galileo went to the University of Pisa to study. His father wanted him to do a medical degree, and one of his forebears of the same name, a couple of centuries earlier, was a very eminent jurist and medico. But in fact, this area didn't fire Galileo particularly, and he came back to Florence in 1585 without a degree. Next slide, please. Pisa is known mathematically for Fibonacci, who was a 14th century mathematician, and in fact today Fibonacci and Galileo are regarded as the greatest sons of the university. In fact, mathematics had been neglected somewhat by the time that Galileo was a student there. There was quite good physics from which he absorbed something, but in fact the mathematics was to be stimulated by him later on. Next, please. This is the Fibonacci spiral, which was, again, a product of the 14th century, and those of you who have come across the Fibonacci numbers I may be interested to see that this sort of geometrical entity has been spun out of that. That's a section of a nautilus shell. Next, please. When he got back to Florence, he became very excited about mathematics through contact with Ostilio Ricci, who was a family friend. And Ricci was fairly quiet about the fact he was talking to Galileo about this because Galileo's father, although talented at mathematics, didn't see it as a good way to recover the family fortunes, and that's still true today. But nevertheless, he became very fired up indeed. Ricci, by the way, was a student of Tartaglia. Next slide, please. And I've noted here where the mathematical genealogy goes, what happens in development of lines of mathematics is often traced through chains of masters and pupils, although I guess we wouldn't use that language today. Tartaglia started a line here. Ricci was one of his students. Galileo was trained by Ricci. And Viviani, who we'll come to later on, was the very last student of Galileo and the one who was had most influence in mathematics and physics. Here's a close-up of Tartaglia. Tartaglia, by the way, is a sobriquet, and it means stammerer in Italian. And he was born in Brescia, which was laid siege to by the French in the early 1500s. And when the siege was broken, the soldiers took out their irritation on the population, and 45,000 civilians were massacred in Brescia by the invading soldiers. Tartaglia survived that, but in fact a soldier cut his jaw and palate, so he was never able to speak properly. His father had died when he was five, when he was halfway through learning the alphabet. He taught himself the rest of the alphabet and then went on from there to teach himself the classics. And by the time he was 22, he was the most significant mathematician in Italy, one of the most significant in Europe. So here's an example of a self-made man against adversity par excellence. His family was impoverished after the death of his father when he was five. So Tartaglia, I should say a little bit more about him. He developed mathematics in the spirit of Archimedes, where pure mathematics may be quite developed, but it's put to use in obtaining a knowledge of nature. And he worked as an engineer, as a surveyor, and was actually a bookkeeper for the city of Brescia. He translated work by Archimedes, Euclid and others into Italian for the very first time. Scholars tended to keep these things in languages not known to the general public so as to keep their preserve, essentially. And Tartaglia didn't believe in that sort of thing, so he did quite a lot to publicise mathematics. I should say just a little bit more about him. He's known for a number of things. In those days, you would quite often have a specialist who would, in fact, challenge another one to a public display. And this happened with Tartaglia in 1530, when he was challenged by Zoan de Tanini de Croix for a public exhibition of mathematics. Each one sent the other a collection of problems, and they were to go through these problems and solve them in front of a crowd of people. And 5 years later, Antonio Maria Fiore did exactly the same thing, and each sent the other about 30 problems. And Tartaglia was able to best both of them in a quite spectacular way, and in doing this, he actually derived solutions for two canonical forms of cubic equation. The quadratic equation most of you will have encountered in one way or another, and knowledge of how to handle that goes back to the Babylonians, but in fact the cubic wasn't resolved until the 1500s, and Tartaglia resolved both of these canonical forms, from which many other things arose in mathematics, going down to Galois theory in the 1800s. It was unknown for a long time how he'd done this. In fact, he was very ingenious at working on some geometrical ideas of Archimedes, and he saw how this could be put in an algebraic form to solve the cubic. It used a problem of Archimedes involving the cylinder and the sphere. This Archimedes solution was lost about by 100 BC, but a scholar, Eutachius, worked out what Archimedes must have done in about 480 AD, Tartaglia translated that into Italian and realised how he could use it for the cubic. So this is a foretaste of what was happening just over a century later, when in fact Descartes invented coordinate geometry. The ideas of it were already there in nascent form in the work of Tartaglia, a very influential man. Next, please. Well, Galileo began to develop physics from the instruction of Ricci, and he looked at a lot of problems. He's known for dropping weights off the Tower of Pisa and noting that regardless of the size of the weight, they would take the same time to hit the ground. Actually, some people have even questioned whether that experiment ever happened, but certainly a number of other people had done it earlier than him, and I've found records of half a dozen of them, the first of which was 1544, which was half a century before Galileo. But nevertheless, he did it with great care and looked at what happened when you put the weights on inclined planes and changed the inclination of the plane, etc. And eventually came up with a law relating to this, which in its final form was the first half of Newton's laws of motion. In fact, so that so this is one of the respects in which influence has come down. He also worked on problems involving centre of gravity, which was an invaluable simplification for some of Newton's work later on. Works on structural strength, and he applied these to contract work with the Venetian Navy and the manipulation of some of their cumbersome military vessels in tight squeezes, etc. And next one, please. Here's another one involving structural strength of materials. Next one. And this is the famous pendulum story of Galileo. And this occurred when he was an undergraduate, I believe, not when he went back to Pisa later, where, in fact, he noted that this very this lamp on a very long support seemed to be swinging very regularly, and he got himself calm and used his pulse to, in fact, time this, and found that it was taking exactly the same time for each beat. And this was a very interesting discovery. Well, as a result of these various pieces of work, he obtained a three-year contract professorship in mathematics at Pisa, where he taught astronomy and dynamics. And he was doing a lot of work at this time and becoming very well known. 1591 was rather a watershed for him. His father died. He was the eldest son in the family, and he had to care for the rest of the family. That same year as his father died, his eldest sister Virginia married, and in fact it was very difficult for him to provide a dowry which was suitable for the marriage, and it took him several years' salary to do it, in fact. So that was quite difficult. So he started off with 60 florins a year salary. The professor of medicine got 2,000 by comparison, but he gradually managed to get this sort of upped over a period of years. And but in 1592, following the problems of providing the dowry for his sister, he moved to the University of Padua, which gave him a higher salary, and he spent 18 happy and productive years there. So here's a sign of... some of these Italian universities have, in fact, got a lot of these chambers very much in the same condition now as they were then, despite the occurrence of World War II. Next one, please. This is one of the implements designed by Galileo, and it's called the Geometrical and Military Compass. That perhaps isn't very informative. What it really is, it's effectively a type of slide rule which you can use for rapid calculations and the military bit being in the field where you might want to work something out in connection with shooting cannonballs, for example. And but it had mathematical uses as well, and he developed a number of things like this, and he had a little shop in Padua where he would sell surveying equipment, things like this, and later on telescopes when that came into his story. And in fact, this occurred even before logarithms were developed, but in fact it was more efficient to use than logarithms in a number of ways. Well, in 1601, his second sister married, and another 2 years' advanced salary were required for the dowry. Universities were very difficult in some ways and very helpful in other ways. I don't think I'd have liked to try to get a 2 years' salary in advance. He also had to support his younger brother, Michelangelo, not the Michelangelo, but Michelangelo Galileo, who was somewhat feckless, in fact, and was a cause of expense for many years. During that time, he had a relationship with a woman, Marina Gamba, from Venice. He'd visited Venice a number of times in connection with his work, and she moved to Padua and lived there, not in the same house as him, but they had three children, two daughters and a son, whom he supported,
But since the, I think he was somewhat concerned about marriage for a number of reasons. But the daughters, in fact, were as they were illegitimate, it would have been very hard to find suitable marriages for them. So they both eventually entered convents, or the same convent, in fact. So he had his shop, and he had some private teaching as well as the university salary to support him. So, well, in 1609, everything changed with the development of the telescope. And as you see, these are objects. In that time, the arts and the sciences were much less separated than today. And many of these instruments were instruments of great beauty as well as being very functional. Galileo merely heard that a telescope had been, a spyglass, I think was the word used, had been constructed in the Netherlands, and then promptly went about experimenting with different sorts of lenses and distances, etc., until he had made, in fact, a much better instrument. And he then turned the telescope to the skies and started finding things. There's a replica. And next, please. 2009 was, in fact, the International Year of Astronomy, the 400th anniversary of the year in which Galileo did a lot of this work. And the sorts of things he found, for example, he found four satellites to Jupiter, and here's a page detailing some of his work there. The this, of course, itself was somewhat thought-provoking, since it was an example of heavenly bodies clearly not going around the Earth, but going around something else. And he called these satellites the Medicean stars. He was always having to find ways of encouraging sponsors to help him in his work. How little things change. He also noted, I should add, that these satellites orbited Jupiter in periods from 1 to 6 days, and he took very careful measurements for years and years, and was with the intention eventually of being able to convert from the exact positions of the satellites at a given time to working out essentially a chronometer to solve the longitude problem, which again was solved a century and a half later. But he had a very good idea for that, and he thought of that pretty well straight away he'd seen the satellites. Next one, please. And here we see some of the detail, the sort of thing that he was writing down. He had ways, by the way, of working out the relative spacings rather accurately, so it wasn't just an indicative sketch. They are fairly accurate distances. Next slide, please. When he looked at the moon, he found craters and what were for a long time called maria, or seas. But the thing is that the moon doesn't appear as in any sense, a perfect object. And again, the sun and moon were supposed to be perfect objects according to the Aristotelian theory espoused by the church at the time. So this was embarrassing. He also found sunspots and recorded them assiduously over a long time. And even his original measurements are interesting now because of the connection between sunspots and climate change. He found there were a lot more stars in the sky that people knew about. He found, let's look at the next slide. Yes, thank you. This shows, in essence, the Ptolemy theory and the Copernican theory. In the Ptolemaic theory, the sun and the moon, with all the five known planets, take orbits around the Earth. And the second theory, we have everything goes around the sun except for the moon, which itself circulates around the Earth. And this idea had already been put up by Copernicus, the idea of the heliocentric structure rather than geocentric. And this was to be the arguing about which of these was true was to be the subject of a later book which got him into a great deal of trouble. Next slide, please. One of the other things he found was that when looked at through a telescope, Venus manifested phases, much like those of the Moon, but in fact the phases of Venus as seen corresponded very well to a heliocentric theory and not at all well to a geocentric theory. So that was another provocative thing. And next one, please. Here again, he's doing a little bit of publicity work, showing the Doge how he is a telescope, and the connections with Venus were very important for him. And interestingly enough, it looks like he actually discovered Neptune. That's 234 years before its official discovery. He could see this object and wasn't quite sure what it was. He could see it wasn't a fixed star, but on the other hand, it wasn't moving quite the same way as a planet. But then it's much, much further out than anything else that was known. And in fact, this was there's quite a lot of story behind that, but I won't finish this talk if I go into that. So we'll just note that that is an extraordinary thing to have happened. 1610, he wrote up a lot of this work in the Sidereus Nuncius, or Starry Messenger, which, again, made his name. His position at Padua was just expiring at that point, and he got a lifetime professorship with a greatly enhanced salary as a result of this work. Well, shortly after that, in fact, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Cosimo II, upped the ante on that and gave him a yet greater salary as a professor of mathematics in Pisa, but no obligation to teach or to live in Pisa. And so, in fact, he was attached to the Medici court in Florence and could do pretty well what he liked, or so it seemed. In fact, let me say a little bit more about the heliocentric theory in the church. One might read this in a simple-minded way just as a fundamentalist question. The Bible is completely right, and there are such quotations as Chronicles 16:30, the world shall also be stable, that it not be moved. Psalms 104:5. The Lord who laid the foundations of the earth, that it should not be moved for eternity. Ecclesiastes 1:5. The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down, and hasteth to his place whence he arose. So, to talk about the Copernican theory is actually to say that the Bible is not literally true, and that is what started to cause problems for Galileo. The idea of the heliocentric world does in fact go back to the Arabs and indeed to the Greeks. Aristarchus of Samos in the 3rd century BC had a very modern model, but of course he didn't have the same sort of experimental support for it that was to come with and subsequent to Galileo. Pope Paul V supported Galileo but said, look, sort of tone down the way you write about this. Just say this is a very effective way of doing the calculations, but don't say that the technique is really true. And, well, he did try to do that, but in fact, that was his first very gentle brush with the Inquisition. 1633, he wrote a very detailed account of this conflict between the two worldviews, and by that time, the Pope had changed, and Urban VIII, who had been a very close friend of Galileo, was the new Pope. He ended up being on trial for this, and then was confined to house arrest for the rest of his life. Well, that doesn't sound so bad, but if you think of some of the other things going on, it isn't quite right. To start with, very shortly before, Giordano Bruno had been burnt at the stake for saying that the Earth goes around the sun. And here is, and he's in the middle picture. So why didn't the same sort of treatment go to Galileo? Well, there's a lot been written about this, but it seems to me that often the full politics of the time are not understood. There was a great power play between the Dominicans and the Jesuits. The Jesuits were very open to the idea, with certain differences of interpretation which were quite subtle. The Dominicans were rather more conservative. Now that was how it was when he was approached by the Inquisition the first time. The second time it had switched round. The Jesuits were very keen to attack the Dominicans, who had taken on board some of the theory, and because and they used Galileo essentially as a way of getting at the Dominicans. In fact, there are a number of other things going on. For example, Urban VIII was a very enterprising pope. He made his brother and two of his nephews cardinals, and managed to arrange a number of titles and property transfer to other family members. And in fact, when things got tight, he instituted three wars, I think, in support of his nephews. So, as you say, an innovative pope. But he was under a lot of pressure from Spain, where they had a stronger Inquisition. And I think that he may well have decided, well, he has to show that he has proper mettle as a pope and hit someone he likes. And the someone may have well have been Galileo. There was also something else going on at the time. There was a man called Orazio Mirandi. He was either the most famous or perhaps the most infamous astrologer of the time, a confidant of the rich and famous, friend of Galileo, and he predicted, just after 1630, the death of Urban VIII. He was a bit careful about this. He had it in an unsigned letter which was had a bogus Lyon postmark on it, but nevertheless people worked out who'd sent it. He was tortured in prison by the Inquisition, and he died suddenly, and the Inquisition went to great lengths to say he was not poisoned. So, Urban VIII was himself an amateur astrologer, so he was very worried at what astrologers might say. And since Galileo was a friend of Mirandi, there again, he was getting a little bit too close to these things, and astronomy and astrology weren't quite as separate as they are today. So I think that in some of these things one may find a rather clearer picture of just why what happened did happen. Next slide, please. So here is the book on the two major world systems which got him into trouble. Next slide, please. The lady, the Grand Duchess Christina, was the widow of Cosimo II, who was a major benefactor and supporter of Galileo, and she continued that with some reservations after Cosimo's death. Next, please. This is a completely bogus picture, of course. It was painted 200 years after Galileo died, but I think it's quite expressive, so I thought I should include it. Next, please. This on the left is the home that he was in, confined in house arrest too, and this is on the Aketri hills, just out of Florence, and you can see Florence in the distance. And very close to where he was living, his elder daughter, by Marina, was in a convent, and she was enormously supportive of him, and we have her letters, which are quite a remarkable inheritance. Unfortunately, the head of the order in which she was thought it was quite unacceptable to have letters from a known heretic, so all the ones that he'd sent to his daughter were burnt, and we don't have them. We have only the ones that she sent him, but they are truly a remarkable collection. And there was a book written, Galileo's Daughter, several years ago, which I commend to you for reading. It gives a lot of information and it's beautifully written. Next, please. This is the house of Galileo from earlier on in Florence. Next, please. And here again is an imaginative picture showing Viviani, his last student, with Galileo. Galileo became infirm and blind, but in fact he was helped a great deal by Viviani and vice versa, and Viviani went on to carry his torch after his death. Next, please. And this statue is outside the remarkable Uffizi Gallery. It wasn't put up until a very long time after Galileo's death. His rehabilitation by the church took time. Next, please. Now, I thought I'd include some quotations from Galileo to show that, in a sense, how modern he was. Next, please. Next, please. Well, I think they're all good today. Next, please. Well, I'll just give a little bit of mention of what happened subsequent to Galileo that was connected with him. I started off by mentioning how Newton referred to him as the giant, essentially. This is what he looked like. Next, please. And this is how he fits into the academic genealogy scheme of things. We start up at the top with Vincenzo Viviano. That Robert Vale ought to be on the right. And he was Galileo's last student. Isaac Barrow at Cambridge did study under James Duport, who was a professor of Greek. But in fact, things got a little bit hot for him politically after a while. He went to Europe and met up with Gilles Persson de Roberval in Paris and Viviani in Florence, and then he really learnt a lot of mathematics. And he then was able to give this input to Newton. Again, Benjamin Poulain was the formal supervisor, but Isaac Barrow was the one who gave Newton the ideas, and a lot of Newton's ideas actually follow on and fit very closely with what Galileo had. There's a line coming down from Newton. Roger Coates was the first one, and interestingly enough, you can see he was born 40 years after Newton, but still died before him. He died young, and Newton said about Coates that if only he had lived a bit longer, we'd really know something, which again is a fairly remarkable thing for Newton to say about anybody. Next, please. If we follow the line down, we see that there's a whole string of people who were essentially tutored by William Hopkins. Hopkins had the sobriquet of the senior wrangler maker. Being senior wrangler was a great honour and a career booster in Cambridge until the time of G.H. Hardy, who was fourth wrangler and therefore abolished the system when he had the power so to do. And Hopkins trained all these people who became senior wranglers, and I think all but one of them was an FRS. And these names, those of you who have seen some tertiary mathematics will probably recognise these names. In fact, they're all very major people. James Clerk Maxwell, in particular, at the end of the last millennium, there was a survey of prominent physicists as to who were the most significant people in the history of physics, and the listing came out very consistently: Newton, Einstein, Maxwell. And Maxwell essentially developed the theory of electromagnetism in the same way that Newton developed a theory of gravitation. And it was a very subtle theory, and he did it with incredibly awkward notation, so it really was quite a wonder for this to come through. I should note, by the way, Sir George, these people all have influence coming down, apart from being significant themselves. And I could comment, Stokes, one of his most prominent students, was in fact Horace Lamb, who was the first elder professor of mathematics at this university. So there is a connection there. And in fact, I'm five down from Cayley on the far side in a line. Cayley is referred to sometimes as the most prolific mathematician of all time, but he did a lot of other things. He was the first of the Cambridge mathematicians to take on a woman student, Charlotte Angus Scott. And she was the first woman to get a PhD in any area, well, in fact, a DSc in her case, in England, and the second one in Europe. And she went to America and trained a whole lot of women mathematicians there to doctorate level. So, in fact, Cayley's being prepared to take Charlotte on was a very productive thing in making mathematics a little bit sexist. Now, that's a pretty impressive roll call of people to train. Next slide, please. Yes, and here are some more. These four are also trained by Hopkins, and you'll note, sort of thinking back to the slide, which you have a photographic image in your mind, of those nine students, two of them were given baronetcies by the sovereign, and one of them was made a baron. In fact, which is not very common in mathematics. So it's saying something about the people here. This, in fact, is getting quite close to the present, but these people have come down and been influenced step by... The people in between Hopkins and Roger Coates are often referred to as being not particularly significant, but in fact... most of them were Cambridge professors, most of them were fellows of the Royal Society, and they did collectively quite a few things. So I think the leaving them out is a little bit misleading. Conclude, I'd like to thank Paul both for making this talk possible and for his very great help in preparing the artwork. My daughter Emma, who helped with some of the slides and indeed is a mathematician in her own right and has given seminars at the University of Pisa. So, thank you very much.